Episode 157 of the Read to Lead podcast is brought to you in part by Cloud Accounting Software FreshBooks, offering a 30-day unrestricted free trial. To claim it, just go to freshbooks.com/read to lead and enter Read to Lead in the How Did You Hear About Us section.
The human brain, yours and mine, is wired in very interesting and particular ways in the way it wants and needs to consume information. When you align with that, you can be an amazingly effective communicator.
Welcome to the Read to Lead podcast with Jeff Brown. Jeff believes that if you desire to achieve true success in business and in life, then consistent and intentional reading is a must. The Read to Lead podcast will not only help you narrow this ever-important reading list, but also bring you key insights and valuable feedback from some of today's most successful and inspiring authors. And now, here's Jeff.
Hi, and welcome to the show that's dedicated to your personal and professional growth, where the topic of leadership is always central to our discussion. But of course, we also dig into topics like personal development, productivity, career, business, marketing, sales, and entrepreneurship. Today, our focus is on sales in the sense that we're digging into crafting and structuring compelling presentations, but not just sales presentations. In a moment, you and I are going to be joined by Tim Pollard, author of The Compelling Communicator, Mastering the Art and Science of Exceptional Presentation Design. I'll ask Tim to share why it is that so many of us present so poorly, his model for structuring compelling presentations, some of the key questions to ask before you even begin, and much, much more. I think it's safe to say I've done more writing in the margins, underlining, and highlighting passages from this book than I have in a really, really long time. If the idea of powerfully landing a small number of big ideas resonates with you, this is your book. Speaking of books, let me share with you briefly about cloud accounting software, FreshBooks. See what I did there? Oh, I'm nothing if not clever. If you're a freelancer or run your own business like me and you've not yet tried FreshBooks and taken advantage of their month-long free trial, I don't know what you're waiting for. There's absolutely nothing for you to lose and everything to gain. Plus, there's a little side fact that it makes me look really good in the eyes of FreshBooks, and that's not a bad thing. With FreshBooks, you get easy invoicing, invoice customization, insight on what's going on with your invoices at a glance, deposits, online payments, that's pretty cool, an easy to follow and easy to read dashboard, expense management, mobile time tracking, and so very much more. You may have heard me say it before, I've been a user of FreshBooks since 2009. I had somebody ask me the other day, I can't remember what the setting was, but they said, is that really true? Have you really been using FreshBooks since 2009? Yes, I have. It's 100% true, and I use it now more regularly than ever, and I love it, and I think you will too. So try it out free for 30 days. You get access to all FreshBooks features because you know me. You're welcome. To claim your free 30-day trial, visit freshbooks.com/read to lead and enter read to lead in the How Did You Hear About Us section. Again, that's freshbooks.com/read to lead. Tim Pollard is the founder and CEO of Oradium, a leading messaging design consulting firm. Oradium clients include a wide range of organizations like LinkedIn, Salesforce, Disney, Rockwell, Ericsson, and Graybar, to name a few. They specialize in training TEDx speakers. Tim is also the author of the book we're going to talk about today. It's The Compelling Communicator, Mastering the Art and Science of Exceptional Presentation Design. Tim, welcome to the Read to Lead podcast.
Yeah, thank you so much. Pleasure to be with you.
I want to say a quick thanks and shout out to Todd Reed, who introduced us and put us together.
Yeah, he's a good guy. Thank you, Todd. It's fun working with him.
Let me start by asking you, Tim, what are some of the reasons, in your view, that many of us present so poorly? That seems to be the rule and not the exception.
It absolutely is. If you look at most commercial companies, they self-assess the quality of their solutions at about an 8 out of 10. They self-assess their messaging of their solutions at about a 3.8 out of 10. If you look in the business presentation world, about 70%, 75% of presentations routinely evaluated at sort of mediocre or worse, less than a third are ever rated at good or better. So we're definitely not very good at this. I think there's an obvious answer, and then there's a much more interesting and deeper answer. There are obvious superficial reasons why we present poorly. People tend to procrastinate. They're lazy. You've all seen that guy on a plane with the little T-Rex arms frantically adding bullets to a PowerPoint for a presentation they'll give when they land. And if you start, you know, on a Thursday night for a presentation on a Friday, you're going to reap exactly what you sow. Mm. For other interesting reasons, you've been told the wrong things. You've been told that the key is eye contact and body language. That's just ridiculous. But there's a whole industry telling you that. So you focus on those things and you're still horrible because those are the wrong things. Mm. And I think one of the other more interesting ones is there's a low cultural bar that's acceptable. Everybody listening to this understands what I mean. When you've been to that presentation where you get slide bombed, where some guy plows through, you know, 60, 90, I mean, even try, you know, 120 PowerPoint slides in an hour or something. It's ridiculous. And nobody thinks that's good, but it's absolutely acceptable. Most of the companies we work with, that's the problem they're trying to solve. So nobody thinks it works. We all throw these decks away, we switch off, we fall asleep, but we all do it to other people. So there's sort of a weird default, which is partly the gift that PowerPoint gave us. Now, all those reasons are real, but they're not the real reason. The real reason is far more interesting. The real reason we present badly is what I said at the very beginning. The human brain, yours and mine, is wired in very interesting and particular ways in the way it wants and needs to consume information. When you align with that, most incredible things become possible. You can be an amazingly effective communicator. But when you misalign with that, you're never going to be effective. And the problem is most people don't know how the brain is wired to consume information, and they don't know how to structure communication accordingly. So let me give you an example. The human brain fundamentally operates at the level of ideas. It doesn't operate at the level of fact and data. So after any conversation, any meeting, any presentation, if someone sat down with you an hour later and said, "You know, Jeff, what was that about?" You won't recount data. You'll say, "Oh, it was kind of interesting. It was about this or this or this." Your brain is biologically reductionist. It reduces things to the level of ideas. Well, if you know that, then wouldn't it be great to build communications that operate at the level of ideas? So I'm going to say, hey, there are three big ideas I'm trying to communicate. And in that way, I would be perfectly aligning with the way your brain wants to work. But nobody does that. If you look at almost all presentations, it's fact and fact and data and data. Fact and data are important, but they're important to support ideas. Most presentations have the facts and data, but they don't have the ideas. Incredible example from history on this. O.J. Simpson trial, 7 months, mind-numbing prosecution testimony, just so much stuff. And the audience, in this case the jury, their brains were just desperately trying to make sense of this. And history clearly records this. It's ridiculous. 7 months of testimony ends up being overcome by one idea of eight words. And everybody listening already knows what the idea is. If the glove doesn't fit, you must acquit. And that's extraordinary. Everyone was already thinking of it before I said it, but it was 22 years ago. The trial verdict came down in 94. That shows the power and stickiness of an idea that 22 years later, everyone listening to this was able to recall that without me even starting the phrase. So, point being, if you understand the way the brain works, then incredible things become possible. But if you don't understand the way it works, you're always going to misalign with it. And PowerPoint, I'm not especially anti-PowerPoint, but PowerPoint is almost perfectly designed, or at least the way it's being used, to violate the way the brain learns. Too much information, poorly structured, too textual, all those kinds of things. So the way we present is almost guaranteed to go wrong.
And a lot of us, don't we use those tools like PowerPoint or Keynote or Prezi or whatever the tool is? We jump into the tool and we start trying to put those ideas together in the tool rather than coming to the tool already having everything fleshed out.
That is a really insightful observation. Almost nobody realizes. It's a little bit of a digression, but if you want to write a document, open up Word. If you want to do some calculations, open up Excel, because that's what they do. But PowerPoint is not a design tool. It doesn't ask you any questions. Who is the audience? What do they care about? What's the action you want them to take? What are the big ideas you need to communicate? There's a raft of critical design questions. PowerPoint doesn't ask you those, of course. It says, click to add title, click to add bullets. It's a bit like designing a building by just laying bricks. It can't work. I don't dislike PowerPoint as a vehicle for delivering visuals. It's really good for that. It's very beautifully designed for that. But as a tool for thinking through the intellectual structure of an argument, it doesn't even exist. It's not what it does. So what people do is they throw everything on slides and they sort of try and reverse engineer the argument out of it, but almost always that doesn't work because you've got 200 slides. That's a horrible way of designing something.
Well, when beginning to prepare for a presentation then, Tim, what are some of the key questions that we have to ask ourselves to make sure that we do the job we want to do?
Traditional thinking is not right on communication in most places. Most traditional thinking is wrong, but in one sense, it's absolutely right. You've got to understand who's in the room, what are their issues and interests and needs, what do they care about, what do they believe about the topic you're going to talk about, are they generally going to be in favor of what you're going to say, are they going to be perhaps resistant to it. So there's some sort of basic things about, you know, like know your audience. Obviously, that's really pedestrian. We all understand that. I think there's probably two things that I would ask that are most critical. One is, what is the specific thing you want them to do as a result of this? If you think about it, almost all presentations in business and almost all communications are about action. We don't present for no reason. I want a customer to buy. I want my boss to back this project proposal or business plan. I want my team to support this kind of tough season we're going to be in. You know, I want the community to back, you know, some proposed change in the town or whatever it is. We present for an action. So the first thing I would do is say, what specifically is that action? You'd be astonished how rare that is. The second question is derivative from that, because the second question is, okay, so what argument will lead to that action? Now, you might think that's incredibly obvious, but if you look at most presentations, the action has not been properly thought through, and especially, you know, clear is the argument is not taking towards an action. So you'll see a lot of sales presentations with, you know, first five slides are pictures of buildings and how many people we've got. It's a joke. You know, will the world map be slide three? How does, you know, a picture of a building help me buy your solution? Because I think your competitors all have buildings. They don't work in caves. So what happens is, if we don't specify the action, we'll never create an argument that's going to drive towards that action. And so what happens is we run into this enormous problem of relevance. Most material in most presentations is not relevant to the outcome. It's background, tangents, unnecessary details, all kinds of stuff like that. And that has usually stemmed from not asking the right questions up front. And particularly the two questions are, what's the action? The second thing you want to ask is, what is the audience's problem that you are going to solve for them? If I wanted you to do something, Jeff, you're not going to do it because I'm a nice guy or I have an amusing accent. You're only going to do it if there's something in it for you. And almost always that comes down to solving a problem. So I might want you, for example, to, you know, to buy my new solution for hospital lighting. You're not going to do that because I want you to. You're going to do it because it solves a problem. So if I understand and can then communicate the problem that you have with lighting and the risk your hospital is running because your lighting is deficient, I'm much more likely to get the action. So I think if there were two foundational things I would do before putting any sort of pen to paper in terms of building stuff is, what is the action you want and what is the problem the audience has?
Well, this is a broad question to ask, and I know we can't cover it necessarily comprehensively here, but would love it, Tim, if you can give us some insight into this carbon atom model that you've developed for designing compelling presentations.
Yeah, the carbon atom is, it's sort of, in a sense, a metaphor. It's a six-component model, and basically, this model allows you to take any sort of chunk, any sort of body of raw material, and turn it into an incredibly compelling argument. It's been proven in, you know, sales messaging, general corporate messaging, leadership messaging. In fact, it's funny, a lot of engineers have been through the program or we work with them on sales messaging and they love it because they can't believe that communication can actually be a scientific process, but it absolutely can. So the carbon atom, essentially what it's doing is it takes the six fundamental brain violations that are evident in all presentations, and it fixes them with basically six tools. So there's a tool for each of the six things, and then it comes together as a single holistic process. So very quickly, the first thing you do is, as I said, you establish what is the audience problem you're going to solve. You've got to place the audience and their problem at the intellectual core of a presentation and sort of dethrone yourself, because most presentations are far too sender-oriented. They're about us, our history, what we do. They have to be reoriented around the audience or the customer. That's the easy part. Mm. Now, the six things, think of it as three pairs. So there's just three things you're trying to get right when you're designing communication. You want the right content. It needs to be in the right sequence. And it needs to be sticky to the brain, so you need sort of the right stickiness or the right engagement. So right content, right sequence, right engagement. Within each of those are two subcomponents. So, for example, the right content. The first thing you're trying to do in sort of the first circle or the first process step is figure out what is the relevant argument that will get my audience where I want them to go. And probably the key thing here is, what are the insights? What are the big ideas this presentation needs to contain? We have a very cool tool that generates the big ideas for the for your communication. A lot of people understand, you know, insight-based presenting, or they understand the concept of insight-based selling, but the problem is, if you ask them where do insights come from, they don't have an answer for that. So there's a particular tool that generates insight. So the first process step is figure out what is the content I need to create that will take the audience where I need them to go. Pictures of buildings won't do it. History, background won't do it. Often, you know, our mission, vision, and values won't do it. It's got to be an argument that's relevant to the audience. The second piece of that, it has to be aggressively simplified. If you were to try and present even only relevant material, you're going to overwhelm the brain circuits. There's a great way of thinking about this. The human brain is an amazing thing, but it only assigns a very small percentage of its processing power to taking in and dealing with new information. And that's why so many presentations are so overwhelming, because they don't understand just how limited the brain is in this regard. There's a great metaphor for this. If you imagine the total processing power of your brain is, you know, kind of the size of the U.S. economy, about $16 trillion. Guess how many dollars are assigned to working memory. Now, we always do this in the classroom, and people are like, a billion, a trillion, a million. And you kind of work your way down. The answer is $3. So $3 of your brain and mind's $16 trillion is assigned to taking in new information. Now, I could get off on a tangent, you know, how the heck do we get through the day? And many of us don't. The answer is, your brain is constantly toggling between long-term memory and working memory. That's how you function. It's why you tie your shoes. You're not thinking about it. It's in long-term memory. But most audiences in most settings, or in fact all audiences, they're thinking about what you're saying, they're processing the ideas, and that working memory is so limited, it's really easy to overwhelm and blow people's circuits. So you have to aggressively simplify your material. You are not dumbing it down. You're adhering, I think, to Einstein's rule that every argument should be made as simple as possible, but no simpler. And what you find is, it's perfectly possible to bring every argument down to what we call a level of what we call elegant simplicity. Every story can be told in the space and time you have available to tell it. But you don't do that by just talking really fast and banning questions. You do it by focusing on the core intellectual structures, argument. So that's right content. Figure out what's relevant, aggressively simplify it. The second thing you have to do is get in the right sequence. Now, nobody understands, or very few people understand this. If you look at most presentations, I mean, sometimes the sequence is as embarrassing as, next slide, please. But most of the time, it's okay, well, that was bullet three, this was bullet four. Let me give you a one-minute detour into how destructive that is. Imagine you went to a cocktail party and I ran into you and I said, oh, Jeff, hey, weird. Hey, here's my old college roommate, Phil. And you say, hi, Phil. And Phil says, hi, Jeff. And then you drift apart. 2 minutes later, what's happened?
I can't remember Phil's name.
Exactly. Now, is there anything wrong with you? Absolutely not. That's a perfect illustration of how the brain works. The brain stores information contextually. It only stores information contextually. If the brain can't find context for a new piece of information, it kind of rattles around and falls straight out the ears, as it were. And the problem with cocktail party Phil is what we call an intellectual orphan. There was no context for the name, so you forget it. You're not being lazy. There's no way you can remember it. The brain does not have a filing drawer that's called stuff for which I had no context. Now, that's interesting. Now, why would that matter to us? Because the moment you put up a slide that's just, you know, five reasons to buy for us, four reasons this project is critical, it's just fill. If there's no intellectual narrative between them. Mm. We have some time later. I want to tell you an amazing story about this spectacularly polished and brilliant CEO who failed miserably at a presentation I witnessed because there was simply no logical structure within his bullets, and everyone forgot everything he said within minutes of him finishing. The way you solve that is you have to take the content that you established in the first chunk of what I described and build it into a logical narrative flow. So A leads to B, and B leads to C, and C leads to D. It's a perfect metaphor, right? You read a book, as we all love. You read chapter 7, it makes sense. Why? Because of chapter 6, and that made sense because of chapter 5. If you read any book out of sequence, you know, think Lord of the Rings, same beautifully written prose wouldn't make any sense at all. It's the same content, but the organization of the content isn't there anymore. So third thing you've got to do is sequence the argument into a logical narrative. It's not hard if you have the right tool for that. The fourth piece you could do very quickly is if in any, this is really interesting though, if in any presentation A leads to B, leads to C, leads to D, what's A?
Right.
One piece of any presentation for which the audience has no context, which is the opening. And research suggests, in fact, proves that you get a fairly high level of your audience's attention for the first few minutes, but if they're not thoroughly engaged, it drops off very rapidly to a very low level and you don't get them back. So what you do at the beginning is absolutely crucial. We call it anchoring. So what is the hour, the 45 minutes going to be anchored in? And that takes you back to the early work you did in your prep, which is what is the problem? You have to lead with the audience's problem or you will not secure engagement. Biggest problem with most sales presentations is the first half dozen slides. So let me tell you a little bit about who we are, how we got started. Here's a building, here's a pond, here's our mission, vision, and values. You are handing the audience the reason they're looking for to disengage because people are overwhelmed. They'd rather not engage if they can avoid it. So that's the right sequence. Sequence it properly and anchor it properly. And then finally, really interesting, is brain stickiness. So the last two pieces, 5 and 6. So 5 is about getting the right balance of left and right brain engagement. Now, let me just try to give you a really quick illustration because that's a little bit weird. Almost all presentations, especially in the Western world, are rationalistic. They focus entirely on fact and data. Now, there's nothing wrong with fact and data, but it's processed essentially in the left brain, and it's not very sticky. Mm. What you want to do is plant your idea in both the left and the right brain simultaneously. And what happens is the brain then creates a neural pathway between the two places the idea is now stored, which massively increases stickiness. It's like a song, right? A song is more memorable than a poem because the lyric is in the left and the melody is in the right. So there are about 5 or 6 ways of planting an idea in the right brain, which when you therefore accompany that with data, creates these neural pathways. Theme parks have this terrible problem that people have a fun day and then they come back exhausted and they've lost their car. Bad way to end the day if you're an experienced business. Universal Studios had a great way of solving this. They changed the basic system of the parks from alphanumeric, like, you know, B3000, to a visual system like Jaws, King Kong, Jurassic Park. But what they also did was they put motion sensors in the parking lots. So now you get out with your family, and the motion sensor detects you, and guess what? You're in the Jaws parking lot. It plays you a sound, and you know what it is, right? So now the idea of where you parked is both visually imprinted through the Jaws image, it's in your auditory cortex through the music, your brain forms a neural pathway between them, and guess what? The loss rate of cars plummeted. So brilliant communicators are able to plant an idea in the brain by planting it in multiple places, which, by the way, is one of the reasons you never, ever, ever, ever do bulleted PowerPoint slides or bulleted slides. There's no point in putting the text up on the screen. You're much better reserving the screen for the proper engagement of the visual cortex through a visual image. So there's a really cool kind of run of argument here of how you take this argument now and make it really sticky. And then the final piece is just what you want to call enduring stickiness. How do you make the meeting last after the meeting? You can only rely so much on human memory. However good the presentation is, you have to give people some form of of takeaway document, especially if you want them to discuss and rediscuss and reconsider your argument later. And guess what? A slide deck is almost the worst form of doing that. Everyone, we ask this in all of our workshops, what do you do with a 100 slide deck after a meeting? Everybody tells you, they throw it in the trash. If they don't throw it in the trash, they're never going to refer to it again. You have to create a brief, succinct, insight-driven document which becomes the take-home after the meeting. So I know that's a longer answer than you're probably looking for. That's the model. You start with a raw body of information. You end up with this breathtaking piece of communication. We see clients see a manifold improvement in effectiveness. You know, sales conversion rates going from 9% to 35%. In one case, 15% to 95%, just through the revolutionary improvement in how they're telling their story.
Well, in the prologue of the book, Tim contrasts two very different presenters. One on the surface looks like the type of presentation we would strive for. The other one, not so much, but that's not necessarily the case. Let's go back to that CEO you hinted at a moment ago and share a little bit of that, if you would.
Absolutely. The underlying idea here is maybe one of the most important things I want people to understand. When you think about communication, you almost always think about delivery. I want to be sparkly. I want to be great. And people will often tell me they want to be a great communicator, but they can't. And I'm looking at them like, no, this is an intelligent person. They can be great. The reason they don't think they can is because they don't think they have that sparkly delivery skill. So the basic contrast is this. It was a CEO. I had spoken at a conference. I was told, stick around for the guy's closing keynote. He is extraordinary. And lo and behold, he gets up, speaks for 30 minutes. He's pacing around, hands-free mic. He's funny. He's witty. He's warm. He doesn't stumble over a word. He is breathtaking by traditional standards. He's got the eye contact of a peregrine falcon and the body language of, you know, I don't know what. He's incredible. But he has one slide in his topic, which is good. He only has one slide. But his topic was the 10 things we've got to get right this year. He moves through them effortlessly. I mean, this guy is amazing. And it ends, and like people are throwing underwear. They're just like going crazy. But I noticed that there was no narrative structure to the 10 things. Well, you know exactly where I'm going with this based on what I said earlier. And I can be a bit of a jerk, and as we're leaving, I just quietly grabbed somebody who'd been in the room, and they'd heard me speak, so they were okay talking to me, and I said, that was amazing, wasn't it? Wasn't this guy fantastic? He goes, yeah, he's such a stud. I said, can I ask you, though, do you mind me asking one thing? How many of the 10 things do you remember? And he got two. And we are talking, I'm not kidding, Jeff, we're talking about probably less than 3 minutes from the close. His CEO saying, these are the 10 things we got to get right this year. Now, this is such a profound story because this is the guy everybody aspires to be, and yet 80% of his argument was gone within 2 minutes. He succeeded as an entertainer, but he failed as a communicator. And what had happened was he made one simple brain violation, which showed up in deficient architecture, which was he didn't understand you need logical narrative flow. There was no connection between his 10 points. They were 10 intellectual orphans, and they were gone. And I knew it was going to happen. He was a great guy. But you can be as entertained as all get out, but if you haven't structured your argument properly, you're going to be forgotten. Now, the contrast is very interesting. Imagine, 84-year-old lady, kind of short, only just over 4 foot, kind of sort of dumpy in a very conservative blue suit, walks out onto a stage, and often at high schoolers, who are a tough audience, right, sits down, sort of puts her head down to the mic, and this lady's been a real estate broker in Indianapolis for 45 years. But she's originally from Hungary and actually Transylvania. So she sounds like Dracula. So she sits down, and for almost 3 hours, she talks. She never gets up. She doesn't use a visual aid. She doesn't do, in a sense, eye contact and body language. She doesn't do anything we traditionally think is important, and we've been told is important on these crazy classes. And yet a year later, I perfectly remembered her three big ideas. Now, what on earth is going on here? The answer is, her name is Eva Kaur, amazing woman. She's a Holocaust survivor. She's actually a surviving Mengele twin, which means she was selected, her family was murdered, she was selected for medical experiments by Dr. Joseph Mengele in Auschwitz. And her presentation is on the three life lessons she's learned from her experience. Now, it's easy to think the reason she's memorable is because it's a Holocaust story. That is not the case. There are lots of Holocaust survivors. Eva herself will say, Eva's very feisty. She'll say, oh, they're terrible. They use PowerPoint. Everyone hates it. I usually have to come in and rescue the conference. It's not because she's a Holocaust survivor. It's amazing how instinctively she got to this. She's architected this lengthy lecture around three big ideas, and she just instinctively navigates to the idea and lands it. And it, because of that, it's incredibly sticky. Now, I won't go into it, but for example, one of her big ideas is no matter what you face in life, never, ever, ever give up. She actually tells a story of getting up in the morning as a little child, washing her face in the latrine of her barracks and stepping over the dead body of children to do so. And it's just a graphic story, and you're like, what on earth do I do with the story? But she does this instinctively brilliant thing that we're trying to teach everyone, which is she teaches insight out of data. So she's got the story, and she says, now, why am I telling you this? That's a very important phrase, by the way. In any presentation, that phrase needs to be in your script, because why am I telling you this says I'm about to go from data or illustration to insight, to meaning, so from what something is to what it means. And so she says, in Auschwitz, dying was easy. Living took every ounce of strength I had. And she goes on to describe, that's the moment when she decided, I will not let this place kill me. I will not be one of these dead children. Never, ever, ever give up. Now, I could take a long time over this, but this is a poignant example. There's a breathtaking CEO who's doing everything right according to traditional thinking, which focuses on delivery. And as a communicator, he's spectacularly ineffective. 80% of his content gone within 2 minutes. There's an old lady doing, quote unquote, everything wrong according to traditional thinking of eye contact and body language and all that. She is spectacularly effective. And what that proves is, if you want to be a compelling communicator, you have to get architecture right. It's all about architecture. If you have great architecture that's structured according to how the brain works, audiences are shockingly tolerant of these so-called delivery deficiencies. In fact, if you listen to Eva Kaur, I realized later, I hadn't even noticed and forgiven these so-called deficiencies. You don't even notice. And the reason all of this matters is a lot of people who think they can't be great communicators are wrong. Because great architecture, if you have the right tools and processes, is within the reach of anybody. Okay, it doesn't matter. She doesn't have delivery skills as we would traditionally understand them, but she had the ability to architect brilliantly. So I'll tell everybody, pretty much anybody with an above average IQ can be a stunning communicator. Because architecture is in the reach of anybody. And by the way, great delivery will not redeem deficient architecture. That's the CEO. So if you had to choose to be a great content architect. And if you're solid with delivery, you're going to be just fine. You can be amazing.
Possess and use the right design tools. Then you can,
exactly.
You can be great too, which is what this book is all about, is equipping you with those tools. Mm-hmm. And it's uncanny to me, as I read the book, I kept oftentimes finding myself replacing the word presenter with podcaster. And so much of what you talk about, you know, things like respecting the audience's time. I mean, that exact phrase is something I've uttered, I don't know how many times, in presentations at podcast conferences and other. Yeah. I mean, that's just the tip of the iceberg. There's so much of what you've written here that I've been trying to instill in my students for 3 years, and I'm going to be using the book in that way, in addition to helping me be a better presenter.
Lovely. I mean, that's really rewarding, and I really appreciate that. It comes back to this thought from earlier that communication is a very broad word and world. It happens everywhere. Tons of our clients, you know, work with us on, you know, sales messaging or leadership communication, but they almost all end up redesigning websites to be more audience or customer problem centric. It is a perfect device for podcasts. It's perfect for webinars, writing emails, writing white papers, writing proposals. I mean, just think about one idea, that you should anchor any communication in the audience's problem. Research suggests that today you're exposed to 3,000 to 5,000 messages in a day. And that if you look at the emails you read, the kind of Facebook posts you engage with, LinkedIn, you probably engage with something like 150, roughly, right? So you engage with about 3 or 4% of what you're exposed to. Now think about that. The average Westerner rejects, so they intentionally say, I'm not going to engage with, about, let's say conservatively, 90 to 95% of the communications they're offered. How do you get to be in that 3 or 4%? Answer, people reliably are more likely to engage with information that solves problems. So if you come at me with some story that's about you, maybe I'll read it, maybe I won't. But if you come at me with, hey, you've got this problem, we can help you solve it. You want to be a great podcaster, but you don't know how. It is far more likely to engage the audience. So you're absolutely right. At one level, this works phenomenally, you know, narrowly defined places like business presentations or sales messaging, and that's where you see a big economic impact. But as I said, speaking to teenage kids, designing podcasts, the same rules apply, because an audience's brain is an audience's brain, sort of regardless of setting. That's not quite true, but you know what I mean.
Right.
The audience's brain is the same, and the same principles of how to reach in and touch it apply, you know, regardless of where you're talking about the, you know, where you're trying to make that happen.
Well, I have a couple of questions, Tim, I want to ask you that aren't directly related to the book. But before I jump into that, anything else from the book you want to make sure we know and walk away with today?
You know, I like that we covered one aspect, which is people want to communicate well. We didn't get into any of the data, but there's incredible data that shows how important effective communication is as a leadership skill. We often are asked to teach on companies' leadership academies because of all the things they need leaders to learn, it's how to communicate well. And for this odd reason that there's an industry built around, you know, delivery skills, people kind of don't think they can be great. And I just want to say to anybody who's listening, you can be amazing, because think about Eva Kaur and the CEO. If you can architect an argument well, you can be breathtakingly effective, even though you might be sort of, you know, B plus on so-called delivery skills. So that's one of the biggest takeaways. You can be very effective without having any of the so-called natural talent. The second thing is I would say, and we can't get into this in detail, is I don't dislike PowerPoint as a delivery tool for visuals, but be careful. It's easy to say, oh, the problem isn't PowerPoint, it's how you use it. Yeah, sort of, but be careful. PowerPoint has certain defaults that sucker you into doing things that don't make any sense at all. For example, they'll have you print your slides to be a handout. Absolutely wrong, 100% of the time. The purpose of a visual is to visually complement an idea. The purpose of a handout or a deck or whatever you want to call it is to provide a documentary record of a meeting. Those two purposes are completely different. They can't be the same. So your visuals and your handout can never be the same. But there's a default in PowerPoint that says they can. So the other thing I'd say is just get the rest of this right in terms of designing a presentation. Then you may be able to use PowerPoint or Prezi or Keynote the right way. But be very careful with PowerPoint. It's not neutral. It will get you to do a bunch of things you really shouldn't be doing.
Well, there's a number of books that are referenced in Tim's book, and some of those may be on this list. But I want to ask you, Tim, what are the books that have impacted you over the years, the ones maybe you go back to again and again, and how is it that they've impacted you?
That's a great question. This is kind of my favorite question. So within the terrain that we've been talking about, there's two or three that I really love. There's a fabulous book by a guy called Daniel Willingham, who's a Harvard cognitive psychologist, called Why Don't Students Like School? He is a genuine brain scientist, as opposed to me being an enthusiastic amateur. He talks a lot about working memory, long-term memory, and how most communication fails to engage teenage kids. I mean, very important principles in there. Moonwalking with Einstein, I'm sure you've heard of, I'm sure a lot of guys have read about how memory works and how you connect to memory. So that's also, I think, been very important. Outside of that, there's a few books I just love. It's probably a book that I've given to over 100 people. Probably my favorite book of all time, which is called The Art of Travel by Alain de Botton. Alain de Botton is a philosopher, and this is a book about why we travel, not where to travel, not how to travel. It's about what travel does for us. So, for example, it makes us more contemplative, and it triggers new synaptic connections. Great phrase in that book, Journeys of the Midwives of Thought. In fact, I borrow one of those principles in my book about if you can place yourself in a creative space while designing a piece of communication, it'll be better communication because you're triggering new synaptic connections in the brain. And then just a terrific fun book, which I just find so interesting and provocative, is a book called Ship of Gold in the Deep Blue Sea by Gary Kinder. It's about how this crazy engineer, what was his name, Tommy Thompson, found and got the gold back from the USS Central America. It's a gold ship that sank after the midst of the gold rush. And the interesting thing was is there were no technologies for finding these ships, and there were no technologies for recovering the gold. He had to invent the entire thing. He was sort of this crazy genius, and is one of the most fun books. So probably between those, I've given several hundred away, and I would recommend them heartily to anybody.
Excellent. I want to give you a chance to talk about anything new that you're working on that might be around the corner. I know the book's only been out a couple of months, so maybe you're still in book launch mode.
Yes, the book's just come out, and we are blessed and fortunate that we are almost turning customers away at the moment, especially on the sales messaging side. So we're just kind of wrangling down the work we're doing at the moment, which is a lot of fun. There's one of the interesting things we're working more on, it was referenced in the book, is the idea of recognition versus recall.
Mm-hmm.
I won't get into that, but if I showed you a penny and said, what was that? You said, it's a penny. Everyone would. If I said, could you draw the head side for me? You wouldn't be able to. And what's meant is that there's a different level of brain stickiness between recognizing something and recalling something. And that is incredibly important because whenever you communicate, especially if you're after a decision, very rarely does that decision get made in the room. It's going to get made a day or a week later. Mm. Research shows 80% of most presentations are forgotten within, a day. There's some McKinsey data on this. Now, what if that discussion is going to happen a week later and they can't remember what you said? That's not going to go well for you. Sales, for example, almost all sales decisions are made several days, if not weeks, after the sales conversation. So what you have to do is present in such a way that your material is not just recognized, it can truly be recalled. In fact, we now say that the ultimate standard of all communication is retellability. In other words, it was good enough that later that day, the person you've met with can say, oh, this was amazing. It was this, 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 and this. So I think we're probably digging deeper into the difference between recognition and retellability or retrievability, if you like, plus just the everyday business of running a company. It's pretty tough sledding writing a book. It was my first experience, and I kind of need a little bit of time to recover from it, I think. There's got to get back to sort of real life, unfortunately.
Well, I want to drive home this point of resisting the urge to build your presentation, create your presentation, if you will, in the tools intended for delivering it. Instead, do that on paper, as Tim suggests, or you might consider using a special app he's created just for this process. Can you tell us a bit more about that?
Yeah, that is one of the most important things. The entire process for designing any piece of communication is in a software tool we built called MAST, the Message Architect software tool. You get that as a byproduct of buying the book or going to one of our workshops. So it's really good fun. You open it up and it does what PowerPoint doesn't do. I'm not criticizing PowerPoint. It says, who's the audience? What do they care about? Where are they going to resist you? What are they going to agree with? What is the action you want them to take? What is the problem you solve? It takes them through the tool to generate the big ideas. It then sequences the argument, takes them through the process of sequencing the argument, and then it takes them through the process of designing both the data, the left brain engagement, and then the illustration, visual, metaphor, allegory, story, things like that for right brain engagement. And what it spits out at the end is a one-page architectural blueprint of that communication. Now you then take that to go and start designing slides and scripts and so on and so forth. I am fanatical that there be most training, you read a book, you forget it, you go to training, you forget it. I'm really fanatical about trying to reduce the learning to application gap, to bring it down to nothing. I want people to be able to do what we've written about there because it really, really works. And the software tool does that. So you you go through that, and then later you go to PowerPoint, and now you know what you're trying to say, you know what your argument is, you know how you're going to open. It's really easy to design slides, which also means this process is way quicker and more efficient than trying to build a presentation in a tool that wasn't designed for that. So people will have fun really playing around with Masks. They get, I can't remember, 6 months or a year free with it, and then it's real modest fee if they want to carry on. But it's the bridging of the learning to implementation gap that we're really passionate about. And so it's fun to go play with it. It's easy, it's great to read the book, but then go play in the tool, and you're like, wow, this is really, really good fun. And you can share presentations, build them collaboratively, store them, therefore, in a vault. It has several other benefits that are really pretty useful.
I'm speaking at a couple of upcoming conferences in the next few months, and I've just started to dig into the tool, and I'm having a lot of fun doing it.
I would love to know how those go and what you did differently, and that'd be really rewarding. So that'd be great to hear.
Well, the book again is The Compelling Communicator: Mastering the Art and Science of Exceptional Presentation Design. Tim, it's been a pleasure to have you on the show. Thanks so much for being here.
Yeah, thank you. It's just really fun talking about this. It was great. Look forward to seeing what the next podcasts are from you.
I encourage you to connect with Tim on social media. One place to do that is on Twitter. He's at his company's name on Twitter. That's @_Oratium, Oratium on Twitter. Again, that's @_Oratium. As always, you'll find the links, resources, and books mentioned at the website page created especially for this episode. And this time around, that's readtoleadpodcast.com/157 for episode 157. As of February 2017, the Read to Lead University Book Club is in full swing. If you'd like to be notified the next time registration for the book club opens, simply visit readtoleaduniversity.com and enter your email address. Or if you're in the U.S., you can text the word university to 33444. I want to say special thanks to Andy, who is the most recent 5-star rater and reviewer in iTunes and calls it simply Great Podcast. Thank you, Andy. For your rating and review of the Read to Lead podcast, simply go to readtoleadpodcast.com/iTunes or readtoleadpodcast.com/Stitcher. And finally, please remember our sponsor and let them know how happy you are that they support Read to Lead. Freshbooks.com/readtolead. Enter Read to Lead in the How Did You Hear About Us section to take advantage of their month-long free trial. Well, that does it for this week. I look forward to seeing you next time for the Read to Lead podcast.
Thanks so much for listening to the Read to Lead podcast. As a subscriber, we challenge you to be more than just a passive listener. Become a vital member of the community. Visit us on the web at readtoleadpodcast.com. Until next time, remember, leaders read and readers lead.